posted schedule shows Senate Bill 1329 is passed out to the floor last night, so it's not on the schedule. The executive appointment we're going to defer for a bit. House Bill 2885, we've requested amendments that are not ready, so we're going to set that at the bottom of the agenda, at least may set it over for another day. We're going to start with House Bill 2833, and I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2833. Is that Tom Byler?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Byler, legislative coordinator with the Water Resources Department. I was hoping that Jan Lee would be here today. She's with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. This is their bill, and I had not prepared written testimony. I apologize for this, but I can tell you some things about the bill, and kind of the bottom line is that we're very supportive of this bill. In the most general sense, this bill involves probably the overused phrase of technical changes to irrigation district law relating to transfers for those districts. I do think that truly this is a housekeeping measure. The bill involves four or five different changes which are minor and have little substantive impact, but would allow the department and the districts to have a more clarity in the procedures involved in these transfers. Let me give you a few examples of the types of the natures of the amendments in the bill. For example, one amendment involves updating what is now antiquated, outdated language regarding what types of rights are subject to transfer. Throughout most of the transfer statutes for entities other than irrigation districts, the term of trade is called a water use subject to transfer. This includes certificated rights, decreed rights, and permitted rights, which are virtually certificated. In essence, they've gone through almost every stage of the permit process, except they haven't received the final order yet. The irrigation district transfers through an oversight more than anything. The statute for the irrigation district transfers did not include that term, water use subject transfer. This bill would add that language in. The bill would also extend a time period for the department to give public notice of a request for a transfer for these irrigation district permit transfers from 7 to 15 days. This avoids kind of a technical glitch that we can run into at the agency, where we have a weekly notice that goes out on a certain day of each week, and when we receive a notice of transfer a day or two prior to that weekly notice, it puts us in a bind in terms of being able to issue that notice within the time required by statute. Extending this for another 8 days will allow us flexibility to move these forward without a snag. The bill would also provide some safety for irrigation districts to safety from forfeiture while their transfer application is pending before the department. Forfeiture simply means that a water right could be subject to cancellation should it not be used within a five-year period. We would not count any time against a water right holder while their water right is in our process being reviewed for a transfer application. This would hold them harmless during that period, basically. A similar provision exists in the other transfer statute. The bill would also allow the department to modify existing certificates without issuing a new certificate. This is kind of a housekeeping administrative detail which will make us more effective and exclude and prohibit some red tape that you would find in shuffling the papers for these types of transfers. Again, I apologize for not having written testimony. I expected that I would be here in more of a head nod role. But I'm happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Dan Lee, please. we...
I'm Jan Lee, Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. We represent a number of water suppliers, specifically irrigation districts. And the bill, as presented, as amended, meets the needs both of our districts and the department in a number of areas. I don't want to repeat what Tom may have already testified to. I'm sorry the Salem traffic was not as domestic this morning. But basically, the bill allows for the department to modify certificates rather than replace them with a new number when there are transfer applications. And that will be an effective tool for both us and the department. There's another housekeeping amendment on definition of a water right subject to transfer that was affected in the statutes earlier for other portions and would make this section comply as well. Notice provisions give the department a little more time to respond to our transfers. And the exemption from forfeiture regarding House Bill 3111 is a temporary provision which would be reversed in a couple years if it were adopted. A repeal of a transfer constraint that was adopted back in 1995 has been offered in this bill because it was found to be an unnecessary provision. And with that, I'd be glad to respond to any specific questions.
Are there any questions or witnesses? I believe you've done well. We've got a bill that has a little controversy, and so we should be able to move it right along. At least with your approval, we're going to close the public hearing on the work session.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2833A engrossed to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Bryant has moved House Bill 2833 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator
Bryant.
Aye.
Yes.
Senator
Miller.
Yeah.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye. Carry?
I'll carry.
Senator Bryant will carry. Close work session on 2833, and we're going to, now that we have everyone present, we're going to go back to the top of the agenda, and we'll be starting with executive appointments, open work session on executive appointments. We have before us today, you've been handed out some materials. There are other materials here that haven't been handed out, maybe. I don't remember.
We don't have that.
Yeah, I think so.
Chair.
Senator Bryant.
I'd move the appointment of Rosemary Davis to the Environmental Quality Commission to the floor without recommendation.
Senator Bryant has moved the appointment of Rosemary Davis to the Environmental Quality Commission to the floor without recommendation. Discussion? Let's call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye. Having received necessary majority, the executive appointment of Rosemary Davis to the Environmental Quality Commission moved to floor without recommendation. Carrier? Senator Miller?
Sure.
Thank you, sir.
You just had to think it was peace.
The We have not received our amendments yet for 2885. We had we have amendments for 2881
as well. Mr. Chair, I've received no amendments to any bills before the committee.
I was informed by the Farm Bureau that they had amendments for two bills in, I don't know which ones they were. Let's go to 2881. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2881. And our witness is next door somewhere. Waiting on the witness. Thank you.
We're in search of a bill that somebody cares about.
Yeah.
Chair, I'm going to step down and let's take counsel for a moment, then while we're looking through with it.
Thank you. Majority, House Bill 2881 is moved to Ways and Means without recommendation. we need to call our representative folks. He's calling, but he's on both seats. I think he's looking for amendments for them. Let's see if we can get Representative Farron Beckett.
Which one are we up on? Chair, which bill? Which bill did you say we're on?
We're going to go to 3259. Again, be at ease until we get some of our witnesses. Here's one of them. No, I haven't opened the hearing yet, but I'm. You can go. You can go get Bruce. Would you do that, please? Pat Egan went after Representative Starr and Chandler, the two witnesses. We have Schellenberg and Atkinson here. I think, folks, we're gonna open a public.
We have Tucker here also.
We're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2838 and ask Representative Atkinson and Tom Schellenberg to come forward.
Randy
Atkinson's left.
And I would be on the right.
It's the opposite for us up here.
True. Well, good. We like to keep everyone guessing.
All right.
Good morning.
We won't be successful with that.
Let's, since our witnesses are all four, let's make it as brief as you can.
Certainly. Good morning. Senator Starr and committee, my name is, for the record, Jason Atkinson, State Representative, District 51. This bill, House Bill 2838, seeks to really do only one thing, and that is to change the representation of the LCDC to a representation that more closely aligns growth and aligns types of organ. And what I mean by that, and we've had some definitional debate around terms, but really trying to get regions that that are growing and regions that are similar in their needs. Currently, the LCDC is distributed, its membership is distributed with one from each congressional district and two others. In the old system, the same person, I believe you're getting a map, the same person who represents the far western reaches of Josephine County down here in the south also represents Ontario and the very fast-growing Deschutes County. So what we have sought to do is to bring all interested parties to balance the need of protecting LCDC, but also getting the representation a little bit closer to what we thought would be the balance between regional growth and population. For that reason, we have amended the bill significantly in the -A4 that are before you. They're hot off the presses as of about 10 minutes ago. And I would like to allow all the interested parties to speak on this real quickly. We have had in the last week 1,000 Friends of Oregon and Farm Bureau and a representative from Robin MacArthur Phillips from the governor's staff. We all sat down and started working on it last week. So without too much further, I guess let Don go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Basically, just looking at your map again, what we've done here as it relates to change, we've created a coastal region. That's something we haven't had before. This guarantees that on LCDC there would be one person who represents the coast and has all of those interests at heart. Now, also Wayne and Douglas counties right now move over into the coast, but you see the line draws through there, and that's kind of an artificial line. We don't know where that line goes, but it does create a coastal region. Then secondly, what it does is it creates a region for Douglas, Jackson, and Josephine. Right now, as Representative Atkinson said, Josephine and Jackson are included on the east side. Well, this brings them over to the west side and couples them with Douglas County. You look at the populations between the various regions, and it's not exactly even, never could be. Well, it could be, because that's the way we have it right now. And that's what the five congressional districts do. But this breaks it up and gives a representation based on geographic similarities, and then we try to make the population as even as we could within those geographic similarities. Well, we think this is a good plan. What it will do, we believe, it's a first step, it's a small step, in decisions that are made by LCDC being a little more regionally sensitive when they make those decisions. So Farm Bureau is a big supporter of this. We would encourage your support as well. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Tucker.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, policy advocate for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. 1,000 Friends of Oregon actually opposed the version of the bill that passed the House, but we've been pleased to work with Representative Atkinson and with Don and with the governor's office to support, and to the point where we support the amended version that you have before you, or the amendments and then the bill that would encompass those amendments. In working with Representative Atkinson, he's made it clear to us that this is not about regionalizing the state land use program, about which we would have serious concerns, but rather about making the statewide governance of the program more accurately represent the diversity of Oregon's regions. And so we do share Representative Atkinson's view that the membership of LCDC could better reflect the regions of our state than it does right now. We had concerns in the version of the bill that passed the House about very large population disparities between regions that were created by the bill. And however, we do also agree that congressional districts, which are equal in population, don't necessarily create any kind of meaningful region from the perspective of land use planning. And we're comfortable with some variation in population between the regions. And say that we really appreciate the willingness of both Representative Atkinson and Don Schellenberg to consider our input in amending and we think improving this bill. We have a special interest as an organization in coastal issues, and as you know, the state land use goals, there are actually at least one and I think more than one goal that actually is specifically about coastal, addresses issues specific to the coast. And so we think it's important that the coast be unified in a region, because the way it is now and under other possible configurations, you have multiple districts, each that have a piece of the coast, but it's unlikely that there would ever actually be a representative from that part of those regions that would end up on LCDC. And so I think that's all I have to say, and unless you have specific questions about the arrangement that we came up with. One last thing is that this arrangement steps away from a pure population-based representation on LCGC, it does maintain a majority on LCGC for the areas of the state that have by far the most population, the metro area of the Willamette Valley, while still providing more representation on a per capita basis for the rest of the state. So,
yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I might expand on that a little bit, just so you know where how it's lined out, where you notice there are five regions, just like we had five regions before, but they're constructed differently. But each of those regions gets one seat, except that the metro area automatically has two seats, and then there's one seat at large that can come from either the metro area or the Southern Willamette Valley area. So that's how you still maintain seven seats, even though you have still just the five regions. One other comment I would make, when you look at the amendments themselves, Section 2 of the bill, of the amendments, is the implementation language. And on page 2, it sets up an order in which this progression takes place. As a conceptual amendment, we would ask you to make a conceptual amendment, and that would simply be to exchange B and subparagraph B and subparagraph D, so that the person representing Jackson Josephine County would rather be the second in order rather than the fourth in order in this transition.
And if I may, the only reason that we like that catch there is that we believe that the next person that was to be selected was from that area, and we're not sure that, given that this would take effect 90 days after the session, we just want to make sure that that placement is held for that position.
Any problem with that? I haven't. Let me comment on that briefly. I don't think I have a problem with that. We have, as we already mentioned, we've worked with the governor's office on the general idea here. And the governor's office was concerned that we include transition language, which now is here. But the governor's office has not seen this transition language, so I think it would be worthwhile making sure that, you know, that this works for them. But the rest of the thing, I think, you know, the rest of the concept that's embodied in this has been agreed to. I don't want to speak for them, they'll speak for themselves, but in our discussions, there was no problem. So I think I would just, you know, I don't have any reason to object to the conceptual amendment. It's just been nothing to do with offers.
We will, I think, deal with the conceptual amendment, move it ahead. If there's any problem, we can re-refer it. Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, is there anything magic about the number 7 other than you didn't want an even number?
Yeah, actually there was, I don't know, magic or voodoo or something weird with the number 7. 7 is a perfect number. The original language had 7. We went twice before we brought the bill to the House, and then in the last week of kicking around the idea of getting it to 9. And the reason why we tried to go to 9 is we could more closely, again, get region and population to match. But that's, quite honestly, keeping it at 7 kept our small coalition here, everybody on board. And for that reason, I think it's something that's evolved.
I guess the question today, it strikes me you've done a pretty good job with, I think, one observation I make, and I think the Jefferson, Deschutes, and Cook County areas are really different than the rest of eastern Oregon. And I wonder if it might be worth having an 8th member, which would make it an even commission. But
if I may, the three of us, originally last week, from Lake all the way up to Gilliam, Wheeler, Crook, right now under the
the Progress Board, Sherman Gilliam, Wasco, Jefferson are already working together. We found a natural split there, quite honestly, the governor, we understand, was considerably nervous about going from 7 to 8 or from 8 to 9 to keep it uneven. So, also the commission felt had mild thoughts concerning the fact that it's hard for them to get a quorum now at 7. So, I sure if I could, I would have 9, but I.
Trying
to keep everybody on the same page.
Well, no, I guess, but, let me see if I just kind of wonder. I understand what you're trying to do. You're trying to build a more rural representation, and certainly you representing your area, wanting to get somebody from the Southern Oregon area on there. But I'm not sure that if I was living over in Burns, that I'd be real happy about having a ski bum from Burns, or excuse me, from Bend, representing my rural ag interests.
Well,
I suppose it's no worse than they have now.
From
their perspective. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, excuse me. It's basically, to my understanding, all of these counties that are in this large district as we propose are currently all in one district as well. And with the addition of, well, most of them anyway, with the addition of more Southern Oregon in that same district. So it's only a marginal change for them. But
If I could add, we've been pulling our hair out because we tried to go Columbia River up. We tried to do what I consider to be orchards into high growth with Hood River down to Deschutes. And then it's just we get into that problem of moving from 7 to 8 or to 9. And
there was a fiscal question. There was a fiscal question as well with handing the commission. It was going to cost money. Where was the money going to come from?
Well, I'd write a check.
Oh, we'll take it.
For Dean.
I'm going to close public hearing of the work session on Senator Miller.
A couple of observations and work sessions, and if somebody wants to respond, that'd be helpful. First of all, I kind of like the original, at least in terms of what it does for areas I represent, Clackamas and Washington. I'm not too fond of the idea of getting hooked up with Multnomah because I think there are significantly different views on how to approach land use issues, and Multnomahs, in my view, are not particularly enlightened. Having said that, in section 2 of your -4 amendments, you talk about, and thanks, Senator Byer, for reminding me, the person who's serving on the commission is authorized to serve for the full length of the person's appointed term. Can you tell me how long that is?
I believe they're 4-year terms. Is that correct?
And is it your reasonable expectation at the end of that 4-year term the person will vacate or there would be a reappointment? As you know, that's an issue on many boards and commissions where it's become fashionable for this governor to continue people in office and avoid their reappointment. And I observe in this particular statute, which maybe, I don't think it's in others, but perhaps it should be, in the current law, as is printed on the A and Gross 38 in what is now section 4, line 20, beginning line 23, where it says, actually in line 24, before the expiration of the term of a member, the governor shall appoint a successor. It would be very helpful language for all of the other boards and commissions where we need to engage ourselves in confirmation. It's on line 24 of the printed bill. Now, again, maybe that can be circumvented as it has been so successfully done by just not getting around to making that appointment. The other thing I wanted to bring up to the members here is that, Mr. Chairman, I would be interested in deleting lines 21 and 22 of the A and Gross bill. And let me see, did the amendments wipe that out? No, they didn't.
My view is it's not especially critical to have at least one member who has been or is an elected city official in Oregon. That's a nice thing to do, I guess, or a nice qualification, but I don't think it ought to be a requirement.
You're looking on the Ian Gross Bill page?
I'm looking on the Ian Gross Bill lines 21 and 22. That would be delete lines 21 and 22. I would make that motion.
Just chair, if I could have comments, I don't want to interrupt.
There is a motion before us at the present time. Comment on the motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Don Schoenberg, Farm Bureau. Leaving those lines in is a decision that we definitely decided we wanted to do. Sorry, Senator Miller. And the reason is cities and counties have agreed to the bill as long as that language stayed in. If that language comes out, then we have opposition from the cities and counties. And again, this is a tenuous kind of thing. So our preference, Mr. Chairman, would be that you not adopt that amendment.
Do you have an indication as to why they feel so strongly about this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, the reason I feel strongly about this, if I can speak, and if Representative Mr. Schlack needs to make further comment, I'd appreciate the opportunity for him to do so, but cities and counties are the ones that implement the land use planning laws at the local level, and there are a lot of procedural things that get involved in administrative rules, and it's very helpful if members of LCDC, if there are members on LCDC who have city and county experience, and that's the reason that language was put in.
In other words, ordinary citizens are incapable of understanding these complexities, and they just can't function without that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, I believe the city and county officials are ordinary citizens.
They certainly are. And so are the others.
Yes.
Senator Byer.
Sir, I would speak against the motion, and the reason has nothing to do with the qualities. I think it's just a matter of, from my personal experience, having served on a local planning commission and the city council, what we're really talking about is the zoning, the relationship of planning and zoning, and I think it's very helpful to the commission to have somebody on board who's been through that process and understands it firsthand, who's frankly, from a local government perspective, when I served there, we're often a little bit frustrated by what the commission did, and I think there's some comfort and indeed some strength to having someone who's been in that position studying there that can add that perspective, and it's only two out of seven members, and again, there's a lot of difference even between a city perspective and a county perspective.
Mr. Chairman, if I might make another comment, in addition to that, these two positions are a second hat that these people wear. So that when an appointment is made from a particular position, from a particular region, if they don't at the current time have someone from a city or a county, whichever the case may be, then they would need to find someone in that region who would meet that criteria also. So they're not separate positions for cities and counties, but they are a second hat that the regional person wears.
I just briefly respond, Mr. Chairman. I don't. I'm not suggesting that that background is not. My criticism of this particular provision is that it's a requirement, and I don't think it is necessary.
Further discussion on the amendment. Proposed amendment. The amendment is that. Suggest that we remove lines 21 and 22 of the printed bill. I think that we have an opportunity to move a bill in which there's general agreement. If we start amending it too much, then we got our problems. I would like to state my opposition to the proposed amendment.
Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Byron?
No.
Senator Byron?
No.
Senator Courtney?
No.
Senator Miller?
Aye. No. The proposed amendment failing to receive the majority has failed.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Barr?
Question to staff. Is there a conflict between section, I guess it's subsection 4 of the A and Gross Bill on, I guess, line 24, where the governor can remove or pause a member and the proposed section 2 of the amendment? Staff or attorney members? It appears that the conflict is in the, as the statute states now, the governor can remove for cause, and it would appear to me that the new section 2 would conflict with that, which says it's authorized to serve the full length of the person's time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't believe that an authorization to serve the appointed term supersedes the disciplinary removal for cause by the governor. They're two separate issues. One is an authorization the governor determines the cause, or an independent commission depending upon what the allegation is.
I just raised the question. It's not a big deal to me. I just wanted to be conflict, but in the case of at least one governor, Governor Goldschmidt's first action as governor was to request the resignation of all appointees. A cause?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's not cause. Cause would be
failing to sit in the
governor.
An allegation. Cause would be an allegation of non-agreement with the party to be.
Okay, I just raised the issue and wondered if there was one.
Senator Byer, the bottom line is the A4 amendment does not supersede current statute.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Byer?
I would move the A4 amendment.
Let's deal with the conceptual amendments proposed first, if you will. The conceptual amendment is to change the priority B for D, B for B on the prioritized schedule. Is there any objection? Not so ordered. Move the amendment.
Now move the amendment as amended by the conceptual amendment.
Senator Byers moved the amendment as amended by the conceptual amendment to House Bill 2838. Any discussion? Any objection?
Oh, good, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Miller objects. We will consider record Senator Miller's objection. The amendments have become a part of the bill, and we will
take a motion. Did you adopt
it? We adopt the amendments, yes.
I would, Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2838 as amended to the floor for the due pass.
Senator Barr has moved House Bill 2838 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Byron.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
No.
Aye. I received the necessary majority. House Bill 2838 moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Senator Barr will carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Close the work session on 2838. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3259. Representative Starr. Pat Egan, John Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Pratt, Representative, House District 3, Fletcher, Washington County. here to testify in support of House Bill 3259. This is a relatively simple bill, and it comes out of your high growth areas of this state, where we've got urban growth boundaries that are filling up. The land inside is rapidly becoming unavailable, where we have areas called urban reserves that have been identified. The urban reserves are planning areas where growth will take place, the next place that the growth will occur. In my area of Washington County, those urban reserves are in planning processes at this point with significant citizen input. And what this bill would allow public school facilities to be sited on those urban reserve lands. I think it's an appropriate and a proper method and place for school districts that are looking for facilities to locate their school buildings. We're talking about public dollars, and we're talking about finding those facilities with growing school districts, the land necessary to build those new facilities to accommodate the growing population. There's been concern that what we're doing is we're going to breach the urban growth boundary and have wholesale development outside the urban growth boundary in a wholesale fashion, eating up farmland, eating up forest land, eating up that valuable land outside the urban growth boundary. And I would submit that that is not the case, that these lands that are in urban reserves, so we're talking about is urban reserve land, and identified the next spot for growth, and those areas are being planned in a public process, making those lands available to build our school facility. I think it's a reasonable approach, it's a reasonable bill. It passed the House committee with I think 2 no votes. And we had a good debate on the House floor, and it had bipartisan support. I would urge you to vote aye on this bill and move it on through this process. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Byer.
No land inside the urban growth boundary?
There is land, but it's not available. We could, the school districts could condemn land. The costs of the land inside are significantly, or very high. And in a process where we have lots of growth happening, it's just not the size of parcels available. And I think my colleagues to the left here will testify, especially in the Beaverton School District, where they really are, there isn't available land for development.
It's all built out.
There is not available land. Available.
If I could just take a minute to attempt, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, to answer the question on that. And I don't know that I absolutely will be able to answer the question. I spoke yesterday with Steve Ladd, who's the Assistant Superintendent of Beaverton School District and the facilities coordinator, and is basically in charge of getting land for future sites, and they have to build a number of sites over the next 20 years in their plan. His and also Jack Orchard, who's the land use attorney for the Beaverton School District. They're, as I recall, my conversation with them is that they've been looking for land and have, and Beaverton did find a small parcel of land, one of the boundaries of which was the UGB, and purchased the land, paid a very high price for it. They condemned another piece of land and have 2 other pieces of property that they're looking at right now for condemnation if they can't go outside of the UGB. And I understand that there are large tracts, fairly large relatively, I guess, tracts of land that are undeveloped but are not available. And so that's sort of the problem that Beaverton and I think Hillsborough eventually will be faced with, is that to stay within the UGB, condemnation really is the only alternative. And I understand that's a policy choice for you to make, but to answer your question, or try to answer your question, I think that there may, if availability is defined as just a piece of land that does not have development on it, maybe there are some pieces available. If availability means, is it on the market? I think the answer generally is no, and they're definitely looking. Beaverton passed a bond here a year and a half ago, I think, has dollars in the bank right now to purchase land, and they are on a constant search for land and have not been able to find it. And just as I recall, Tuesday you heard from a representative of the church that was looking for land that had employed a real estate agent in Clackamas County and was faced with similar problems. Can I answer the question and say, by golly, there are not 5 and 10 acre tracts or more as I sit here right now? I don't know for sure, but that's what I've been told.
God, it seems to me that a great case against land use planning. It's too expensive to have urban growth boundaries.
Well, Mr. Senator Byard, that's part of the reason why we're here is because we've had a land use policy that has worked. It has had infill and development taking place.
That the prices up.
Absolutely. It drives the prices up. When you limit the supply, the prices go up. And that's reality. And the problem, or the, I don't know if the problem, but the downside of that, if you're talking about spending public dollars on inflated land prices, it's unfortunate that we have to kind of, you know, juggle those two good issues, land use policy and having to spend more money for it.
Senator Miller.
Again, I appreciate what Senator Beyer has done in his questioning. And I would say the assertion and the understanding that the planners have been effective at driving up the price of land is certainly true. And also they say that they've been very successful with driving down the quality of life. Now, the question I have for you is, if this is such a hot idea for schools, why doesn't it work for families?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I necessarily wouldn't disagree with you, but we're in a process where we want to get a bill through this legislature, and that still deals with public schools, and we hope to move it forward and hope to have the governor sign it.
Go on further and not be able to help.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Would you allow the representative to clarify, and then we'll open it up for questions again.
Senator Deckard. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't reiterate what others have said, but I would say one thing to Senator Miller's point is that it is the high quality of life that I think we certainly enjoy in Beaverton that brings about the need for this legislation is because we have done the infill, which has, and I've seen in 20 years in Beaverton, has really positively affected the quality of life in terms of schools located somewhat close to the community where you don't, as much as possible, have the situation where you're busing kids around. Although that is why we brought 3259 forward, is because we face a situation where we need now to look into the urban reserve and into the buildable lands.
Representative, could you state your name for the record for bars, please?
Yes, absolutely. I'm Ryan Deckard, represent Health District 8 in Beaverton.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Gordon.
It is not a restaurant.
It's a personal liberty issue.
would we have further questions from me?
I sure would.
So, if you were to build these schools in the urban reserve areas, where would the kids live who were going to go to these schools?
I can respond to that, at least give a shot. This doesn't happen in a vacuum, for one. It's a public process. In fact, in Hillsville, we're planning our urban reserves right at this time, as those lands are going to come on in the next few years. The public process. On one side of the street, you have development. On the other side of the street, you have urban reserve lands. It's not like these kids are going to have to, you know, go several miles to go to school. It's one side and the other.
Maybe true in the coastal, but how about in other cities in the state?
I can't necessarily speak for other cities in the state. Where I'm coming from, the metro area, where we're dealing with this in a high growth situation.
There's been an attempt, I shouldn't say this, to just recognize reality and expand the urban growth boundary in a logical way.
But, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, one of the notions behind this is the price of land and being able to acquire land today at relatively inexpensive or comparably inexpensive prices versus 20 years from now when these are buildable lands. So when when they're out there building upon them in the LCDC approved urban reserves, the price of land will just escalate.
Representative, are you talking about the need to build, to buy the land today to start building on it today, or are you talking about the need to buy the land today for building in the future?
Both, but and Tack can speak to this in terms of from the school district perspective, but one of the arguments is just being able to, and Pat, I don't know if you want to...
I'm not aware of any restriction that would keep a school district from buying land wherever it wants.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe that that's correct. The question for the school district, I think, would be if they're to purchase the property and then not to be approved at some point in the future. Obviously, it's a commodity that they've got that they could transfer to somebody else, but that's just an issue of economics. But it doesn't solve the problem for them, especially for the Beaverton School District. And if I could just get into a quick bit of my testimony right now, there are 45 facilities in the Beaverton School District. They have just over 30,000 students, 32,000 students right now. According to Metro and PSU studies, they're to grow in the neighborhood of 15,000 to 20,000 students over the next 20 years. That's another probably 20 to 30 facilities that Beaverton is going to have to site. The availability of land, again, is really the issue, and the ability to actually build on it and get approved for it is also the issue. But,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Senator Courtney's amusement, I would say, with some chagrin to tell you that this bill is very, very similar to a bill that I carried and passed in 1995 at the request of my school district. That's for both houses only to have a governor veto it. And frankly, I'll tell you, he was right. My school district was saying, we can't find any land. There's no land. They had a site that's just across the street from the urban growth boundary. And you know what happened? We built three new schools year before last in Springfield. None of them were outside the urban growth boundary. And one of the reasons that they built the one that was supposed to be outside, they found out after having purchased the land, which they later had to sell, was that the cost of extending services was substantially higher than they had thought. And so they ended up, it was cheaper to buy land, more expensive land, inside and build inside the urban reserve, urban growth boundary where there were services. I understand the problem, which I would also say that note that the governor doesn't only veto Republican bills.
Predominantly.
Senator Miller had a question, and I have a comment. In our area, there are places where urban growth boundaries is on two sides of 400 acres of land that is in the urban reserve. And so we've got public services on both sides of this urban reserve land, and that occurs in many areas within our region. And so,
but Mr. Chair, that's not a statutory problem. That's a planning problem. That's a local problem.
That's why we need help with this kind of bill.
Sure.
Senator Courtney, well, Senator Miller had to ask first.
It's very brief, Mr. Chairman. One is, there's this, and from Senator Beyer's question, I'm sure there might be this result that houses would actually be built close to the school, and of course, I know the governor would be very concerned about that. But I'm also of the opinion that we shouldn't necessarily think that other uses would not be allowed. After all, in a significant urban reserve in Wilsonville, the governor wants to put a prison. So maybe that's an educational institution. I don't know how this is worded. Go ahead.
Senator Courtney.
I'm not familiar with the comprehensive plan in your area. I am familiar with the Salem, and I'd like to put together Salem one with us on the Salem City Council and Julie over those boundaries. Salem is now moving up against the boundary, and it needs to adjust its boundary. It needs to start to redraw its boundary to include more land. And I assume from the comments that you've made and others have made that every one of your communities in that area are filed requests and are in the process for their planning commissions and their planning of expanding and adjusting the urban growth boundary and initiating that process.
It's a done deal. I think for we've got some witnesses here that can testify to that, but we have.
So they're going to have enough land in the urban growth boundary to accommodate these kinds of needs.
Only in
Mr. Chair
of the region.
Senator Courtney, the Metro Council and the metropolitan areas are the ones that make those decisions for us. The Hillsborough City Council, for instance, or the Hillsborough Planning Commission doesn't have the ability to make those decisions for the Hillsborough area. It's done through the Metro Council. That decision was made, and then it was appealed to NUVA, and it's in its appeal process at this point. But there are lands that are identified as urban reserve lands that are the next logical and place that growth is going to occur. Those lands are already in the planning process to allow for growth to occur there.
So what I'm saying is those lands are anticipated to be within the urban growth boundary?
Yes.
Okay. And you have drawn the urban growth boundary, and with that boundary that had not been appealed, there would be sufficient land to accommodate some of these uses?
Yes.
I assume the only thing that's holding up in not granting these uses allowing this new urban growth boundary area, somebody went and appealed the drawing saying to move it.
Right.
Is that right? So, well, see, what you're telling me is this is exactly how the system was designed to work. Exactly how it was designed to work. That there was nothing sacred or absolute or, I forget the line the Germans built that said they couldn't be penetrated. It had the famous name to it. And they found out the hard way it could be penetrated. There was nothing set in concrete. The urban growth boundaries were designed to be able to be moved. And so, in effect, I regret the fact that somebody's appealed it, and I'm sure you regret it too. And I don't know what Groove is going to do with it, but that's the land use process we have in the state of Oregon. Now, if we want to get rid of it, and there are a lot of people sitting in this room who would like to get rid of all land use planning, all urban growth boundaries, and let people do whatever they want to do, that's fine. But I think this is the case that Senator Byer and I end up not speaking to each other for a month on. In addition, I had the same situation with Silverton, and they didn't speak to me for a year, even though they now have the most beautiful high school in this whole area. And so I've been through this before, and, you know, I realize where the votes are, Mr. Chair. So I think what you should do, Mr. Chair, because you've been expediting things like crazy lately, is you should, if anybody else wants to testify, that you might as well just thank these gentlemen, get your votes, move it to the floor, and be done with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's not play games. Let's just flat out, let's just rock and roll. Let's not talk anymore. The votes are here. That's it. That's good.
Mr. Chair, can I just one thing for Senator
Cardin?
You
had 2 weeks before.
Give me the hot tea in the afternoon.
Okay, I went through a Western Oregon experience earlier in the session. If I could
don't mind him about that right now.
If I could just make one suggestion or one comment.
You know, Mr. Chambers, on Western Oregon University.
I understand that.
Is there a provision in this bill to change Western Oregon University's name again?
That's in the amendment.
Anyhow, my point is that I don't share that vision in terms of undoing the land use planning system that we have, but I do think this is a reasonable accommodation that is contained under current statute, which makes, at least when they brought this to me, a very reasonable accommodation that fits very well with the overall Metro 2040 vision that we have, at least in the metropolitan area.
Real briefly, Mr. Chair, if I could, and I hope it'll be less than a month before you start.
Sure,
talking to me, Senator Gordy. Just to address a couple of those points, as you're aware, I think Deschutes County is the only county that exceeds Washington County in growth. This is really a growth issue. Over the last 10 years, you have roughly 9,000 students added to the Beaverton School District and another, as I said, 15,000 to 20,000 to be added in the next 20 years. They have a site facility problem. that really keeps their assistant superintendent busy on land acquisition virtually every day. And speaking with him yesterday, he has been part of the process. He has been discussing the issue with Metro. He, however, does not have control over where the boundaries are drawn. I think the in the Beaverton School District, the areas that they're looking at are for acquisition in the urban reserve are not areas that are leapfrogged 3 miles out. No school district, I think, has an interest in siting a school in the middle of nowhere and forcing students to be bused, as Representative Deckard mentioned. And they're looking right now at a site that potentially, if it got approval, would be basically right across the street from the Washington County PCC Rock Creek campus. There are dwellings out there, multifamily and single-family dwellings. And so I recognize and understand and agree with, I think, your observations on the process and all of this working. The urban reserve, I think, as we interpret the statute, are for future expansion and specifically mentions public facilities. So that's my comment.
Sure. Senator Cordon, I might suggest that you suggest to your clients that they can get prayer back in school. They can't leave Paul 3 miles out because we passed the bill out and allows the megachurch to be 3 miles out. So if you can get some religious spiritualism in these schools, they're all set to go 3 miles out. So we take care of that. You might think about that.
Sure.
That bill's going to play the Senate.
Senator Bryan.
Charter.
Charter.
I represent our local school district, and with the high growth, what saved our basin, and it was not intended to save the basin, but bend the neck out to the urban growth counter. And that freed up land for schools, and we passed the bond measure to build a new high school. The only space I could find inside the urban growth counter, or inside the city limits, was very expensive, and the landowner knew it. I mean, it increased the cost dramatically. But when the election took place in November, suddenly other land opened up, and the school district opted now to buy another piece in order to accomplish them. It does require them to have a higher expenses in the way of sewer and water and roads, but it's still a lot cheaper than the land they would have bought. In probably about 1993 or so, they also passed a bond to build three new schools, and the site they selected for the new junior high or middle school was just outside the urban growth boundary. And we went through a very quiet process that if anyone would have appealed it, we would have been stuck. But no one appealed it to Luba. But it was by the skin of the teeth the school was needed. And, I mean, this was just right outside of it. But to go through and change your urban growth boundary and go through that process would have been very time-consuming, very expensive. It would have taken a couple of years, probably. Mm-hmm. And the school district simply didn't need it. So, to me, I'm not opposed to land use planning. This is a reasonable exception. We learned from the experience of the land use planning we have. And I think it's good for the taxpayer. I think it's good for the community. I'm going to support the bill.
Representative Barr,
this comment. I processed some of those urban growth boundary changes when I was on the city council. Ours is a little different than Metro. We just had two cities and the county to control that one. I think it took 3 months to go through the whole UGB amendment. It was a small one, which I would assume if you were doing it for that, it doesn't have to be. I mean, there's a difference between doing a logical small adaptation, particularly into an urban reserve, trying to amend the entire damn plan for metro areas. I guess I would say it differently. And I would like to say that this is not just a problem in Hillsborough or Beaverton. Bethel School District in Eugene is having exactly the same area because all of the growth, and maybe a smaller rate of growth, but it's all occurring on one side of town. My community, Springfield, is having that. They're looking at having to build another school or two in the next couple of years. But fortunately, they've looked ahead and bought some sites, so they have some opportunities.
Mr. Chandler.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association here on 3259A. I've submitted written testimony, I won't belabor it, but I would like to, if I may, take the opportunity to respond to a couple of things, questions the committee had, and a couple of statements that were made. Specifically, with regard to Senator Courtney's comment that this is the way the system is supposed to work, I would take issue with that, frankly. The system is not supposed to result in 6 years' worth of work and an interminable amount of appeal, which is what we're facing in the metro area right now. In case, after seven years of work at Metro, has been appealed by not just one person, but a gob of persons, Sulu, but after Urban Reserve designation, they haven't done the Urban Growth Boundary appeal issue is also on appeal, and we're looking at, realistically, in the metro area, an unresolved situation for the next 4 or 5 years, when, to the point where we actually have asked the governor to intervene and call for mediation trying to fix it. And I don't dispute your point, Senator, that the land use system is designed to accommodate needs in an orderly fashion. I would submit that, at least in that particular instance, it did not do so. This bill is an attempt to get ahead of that curve somewhat. When jurisdictions adopt urban growth, urban reserve areas, they are saying essentially this is where the growth is going to go in the future. Not tomorrow necessarily, not maybe in 10 years from now, but in the future. We know this is going to urbanize, that's what the statute says, that's what the rule says. Allowing schools to get out there ahead of the urbanization, ahead of the housing, ahead of the jobs, to essentially allow schools to do what the legislature has told them to do a number of times, which is to get in the game, grab a mitt, and go. And that's get ahead. Try to figure out where things are going to happen, get there first, pay less money. In the metro area, and I can't speak for Eugene and Springfield, but in the metro area, we're looking at $200,000 an acre land out in Washington County, inside the urban growth boundary. Outside the urban growth boundary, it's probably in the neighborhood of $10,000 to $20,000 an acre. Now that, from our standpoint, was a good enough reason to blink a little bit at hard and fast land use rules, simply from a public policy and public finance standpoint. The other comment I wanted to make is the notion that these schools, if located outside, would result in growth occurring there. And that is just the reddest of red herrings. Anybody who drives between here and Portland sees the lines of houses along the freeway. This notion that if you do something outside the middle of the boundary, all of a sudden growth immediately follows and swarms onto it, simply isn't true. Land use controls are still in place, county zoning is still in place, LCDC is still in place. The location of a school allows the location of a school, period. It doesn't allow the location of housing adjacent to that school. The notion that farmland is going to be taken up, I suspect some of the other witnesses you'll hear from will talk about that issue, that farmland will be used, and I would point out to the committee that if an urban reserve is designated by the local government, it has to have holy water sprinkled on it by the LCDC. And if it happens to include farmland, it is only because LCDC has decided after due review that the farmland is okay to be in there. At that point, it no longer is farmland. It is an urban reserve. The same way that farmland inside the urban growth boundary is no longer farmland for purposes of Oregon law. It is now urbanizable land. So again, it's not like we're going to be going out there and plopping schools down in the middle of prime farmland. If any prime farmland is in urban reserve, it's because the powers that be have deemed it to be acceptable and the ag economy in the state won't crash as a result. This is a very minor bill in the grand scheme of things. And it was one of the frustrations I'm feeling in that coming out of the House with a very close vote and a very narrow lot of debate on it, is that there's a public policy issue, I believe, between maintaining the firm, unwavering land use system and one that recognizes our land use system, as with other public policy issues, is one where adjustments can be made to reflect other social needs. In this case, the need for schools to find land to build on, the need to not spend $200,000 an acre. It's a policy issue, and reasonable minds can and do differ. But in the House, a lot of the debate and a lot of the testimony occurred that this is an assault on the land use system as anything but. I think it's a way of supporting the land use system by allowing it to work better and allowing avoiding the disconnects that can otherwise happen. As Senator Courtney pointed out, if you have a church, that bill, if you're out far enough and they're outside the urban growth boundaries, you don't need a bill at all. Schools are allowed use, and it goes to farm use zones, so long as they only serve farm kids. This does say that we can have schools slightly outside of urban growth boundaries that will serve urban kids, but the net effect on the land use system or on the agricultural productivity or anything else is going to be probably negligible. The impact on schools will be immense. I encourage you to support the bill. Glad to take any questions.
Thank you kindly. We got other witnesses signed up. Appreciate your testimony.
Chair.
Mary, Kyle, McCurdy, Bob Rindy. We've got
Good morning, Chair Carr, members of the committee. My name is Mary Crowell McCurdy with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. 1,000 Friends of Oregon opposes House Bill 3259, and I have some comments I'll pass out here, but I'm mainly going to address some questions and issues that have come up. House Bill 3259 would allow the location and construction today of schools and urban infrastructure in urban reserves. There's nothing that prohibits a school district from purchasing land today for future use as a school need becomes known. This would allow the construction of schools today in urban reserves. And let me explain a little bit about the urban reserve law, because I think there may be some misconceptions. Urban reserves are those areas where an urban growth boundary might expand once the 20-year land supply inside the UGB is used up. There is no guarantee that the UGB will actually expand into any of those urban reserves. That's a separate decision made down the line by the local government. The Portland area is designated urban reserve, so has Medford. Other cities might. So areas designated urban reserves are local government's best guess as to where it might expand its UGB 20 years out in the future, but it might not expand there. And that's why when urban reserves are designated, contrary to Mr. Chandler's comment, the land that's ESU remains designated ESU. Urban reserves typically include some exception areas and some ESU lands and forest lands. Those lands designated today for resource uses, even if they are designated for urban reserves, remain zoned for resource use, and farming and forestry is intended to continue. So that land remains designated resource use until it's actually brought inside an urban growth boundary, and then it's urbanizable. The schools and the facilities listed in this bill are urban uses and should be located inside UTDs where the existing demand for them is located. This bill, currently in the metro area, schools are allowed on exception areas. And I have a map here that Randy Pecker is going to show you of the urban reserves, of the exception areas, excuse me, in the Portland area. This is the Portland urban growth boundary. The areas in the orange-gold colors, all of the colors, are exception areas outside the urban growth boundary. Today, a school can be located on those exception areas. This bill is just about allowing the construction of schools on farmland, because they can be constructed under current law on exception areas today, regardless of their urban reserve designation. That's a lot of land that's available for school sites today. This bill, by allowing things,
can you point out on that map where Beaver's going to help for it?
This is roughly Hope Row, Beaverton. This is about 4 foot Hope Row area, Beaverton in here.
Is that black line the urban growth
yes,
boundary?
Yes, black line is the urban growth boundary.
Beaverton is further to the east.
Beaverton is right around in here, right? This is the St. Mary's property. This is the property.
That's right. That's
right. This is exception areas that are also designated as urban reserves. All these gold, yellow areas all around the boundary.
Just the St. Mary's piece there, just west of the St. Mary's piece.
West of the St. Mary's piece is a large area of exception areas that have been designated urban reserve, and that there's, well, actually today there's going to be a settlement decision made by Metro, and those areas will be coming into the urban boundary.
Two of Hillsborough's three high schools are within a mile of that exception area.
And these exception areas here are scheduled to be brought inside the urban growth boundary.
What I'm saying is two of the three high schools are within a mile of that exception area. They would not want to put a fourth high school that close to the other two high schools.
We suggest that the process, if a need exists today for a school for an urban use, that the urban growth boundary be amended. That's what the West Wind School District did in the urban reserve designation and UGB amendment process. They designated a school site. It has come inside the urban reserve, and it's now inside the urban growth boundary, and it has not been appealed.
Do you happen to know how long it took them?
The West Wind School District?
The amendment?
As long as it took Metro to go through the urban reserve and UGB the last few years. It was never controversial bringing in that site.
Years.
A few years.
Never controversial, but it takes years.
And if it's controversial, it takes 4 years.
Well, it went through the urban reserve designation process first, and then the UGB expansion process. They could have just gone through a UGB expansion process. I frankly think the urban reserve process is unwieldy, but that's subject for another discussion, possibly. A few school districts may well be having trouble finding land that they can afford to site a school on today inside the urban growth boundary, but we don't believe that the issue of inadequate school funding should be met by compromising our land use system and exclusive farm use zones. And why are some school districts growing so fast that they need additional land? In the Portland metropolitan area, the primary reason is rapid job growth. And we suggested a more direct place to look for funding for school sites, maybe places like the Strategic Investment Program or to authorize system development charges for schools. Finally, about 2 or 3 sessions ago, I can't remember exactly which session, you passed a bill that required fast-growing school districts to coordinate their land use planning with their local governments. And I hadn't heard an explanation of why that hasn't worked. That was particularly applies to high-growth areas like Hillsborough and Beaverton, and no one's explained why this process is not working and hasn't worked to locate school sites. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation Development, and I have handed you some written testimony. I don't want to cover all of that today, and it sounds like most of those issues have been raised by others. I also will echo Mary Cal McCurdy's disagreement with Mr. Chandler's assertion that once farmland isn't an urban reserve, it is not farmland. I was the staff person who developed the rule concept that later was embodied in statute, and I'll tell you that getting agreement from parties, from all the various parties, that there ought to be such a thing as an urban reserve in Oregon, it was very crucial to that decision that we all agreed that this was a something that was to earmark land 10 to 30 years in the future. It is not land that just tomorrow or overnight is going to be urbanized. Moreover, the farmland in those urban reserve areas needs to be preserved as farmland. And everybody declared that as we declared this tool. It was all understood, and here today we hear people saying it's not farmland, and I really want to take issue with that. I will point out that from time to time, many different kinds of industries or uses come forward and say, we can't find enough land. People who are looking for land for commercial uses, for industrial uses, you heard it last week, churches. You heard it earlier in the session, we heard it for composting facilities, for people in UGBs who would take their garbage and compost. Folks come forward and say, we can't find land in the UGB. What they really mean is we can't find land in the UGB at a price we want to pay. And gee, we just happen to notice that the land use program has successfully kept prices for farmland low. That was the point. And the way the land use program has succeeded in keeping farm prices to prices that farmers can afford, I think, is by not systematically allowing a series of new uses, constantly allowing new uses in farmland. And we've had to fight that tooth and nail every session, and we're not necessarily winning it. We have about 50 uses now that are allowed on farmland that probably have nothing to do with farming. And this would be one more. This would be a major use. Schools bring growth. They bring traffic. They bring sewer and water facilities. They will lead the UGB and the surrounding area into an area that is not selected by the city officials who are trying to plan their land. Unfortunately, school sites are selected by a school board. Their interests are might be the price of that land, not whether it's logical for the city to grow there in the near future. What we are discounting when school districts select sites that are distant from urban areas is that the busing costs are public costs. The cost of transporting students are paid by the state. When the school district picks a site far out from a boundary, they don't count on the cost of that site, the long-term, year-after-year costs of busing all the students, transporting all the students, some which are private costs.
I can tell you that Ben Fine School District does, when they consider where they're going to locate, since we have buses that run all the way down to La Pine, which are 32 miles, every time they locate a school, they do a bus study on what their cost is going to be immediately and long-term at that location. It's built into their decision-making process of where they think the best location will be for that school.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryant, that they may do that. My understanding is most districts don't, and the reason is that the state pays those costs. And they may calculate them, but the state will then pay those costs, and so the districts will count land as cheaper that is far out from the boundary, in which, in fact, may not be to the public in general. It will be cheaper to that district.
Mr. Chair, the state pays 75% of the basic transportation costs. It doesn't pay the other 25% and some other incidental costs that are tied into that. It's still an expensive proposition for school districts to have large bus fleets.
Thanks, Senator Bryant. That is true. It's expensive, and that's my main point. We're trying to keep schools in the urban areas for that reason. We think it is a land use matter and as a matter of public policy. I'll note that not only Springfield in 95, but Silverton in 97 came forward with a bill in order to just cite a school just outside of UGB. Silverton did, after that bill failed, find a wonderful site inside UGB's, inside their UGB. I've raised several other points in my written remarks, and one of them that I didn't raise is the fact that that Metro, and of course we have to think of this bill as affecting UGBs throughout the state, and for sites that are adjacent to UGBs, it is possible to amend the UGB, and I think it would be a better solution for Metro and for other districts. When looking at a site adjacent to the UGB, it would be a better solution to amend that boundary than to adopt a bill that statewide simply waives the disencouragement to the cities locating outside of those areas. And I'm not aware that there's been an attempt, whether or not there's been an attempt in this particular case, but I am certain that that is an approach that ultimately should be tried, that Metro has a minor UGB amendment process. It's not the major UGB amendment process that we've all been discussing here. It's a more of an adjustment process, and I don't know why that wouldn't be a solution for this particular school.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Three basic questions. One is, what has your experience been, Bob, with timelines of processing urban growth boundaries throughout Oregon? And I just want to tag onto that piece there. Do you have a sense or know what the timeline is for the minor amendment process in Metro?
Sure, Senator Beyer, I don't know what the timeline is, and we haven't studied the timelines. I do have some statistics. I don't have them with me today, but I can provide you about how many UGB amendments there have been in the last 10 years, and there really haven't been very many. But I know that we didn't keep track of how long those took. I know we didn't. We don't know.
Do you know?
Chair Starr, Senator Beyer, I know something about the minor amendment process at Metro, and I know it's a generally quasi-judicial process which falls within the statutory requirements for processing them within 120 days and 80 days. And last year, Metro had several, and has before it now, several minor adjustments for urban growth boundaries that it will process in a matter of months.
Can they be appealed?
Certainly, just like any other land use.
Most of them been appealed?
We haven't appealed any, and I'm not certain. I don't know of any that have been appealed.
If they are appealed, how long do they take?
They would take the same amount of time that any other land use appeal does to the Land Use Board of Appeals. I mentioned in the case of the Westland School District, it chose to go through the Urban Reserve and Urban Growth Boundary Amendment process, I assume because that was for a school site that they don't immediately need or have the time to plan for it. It was never controversial or appealed. They could have gone through the minor amendment process, too. I don't know why they chose not to. Well, Senator Starson, from the point of view of those of us who did appeal the urban reserve decision made by Metro, that particular school site was not an issue for us. It may have had some local controversy, but in terms of it's not a part of the appeal that we made, which is
the second one is, do you have a sense of how much land is available within the sort of the Hillsboro-Beaverton area that's vacant could be built on?
Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't have that today, but I think we can through Metro get you some sense about how much land is vacant. But the real key question, as you heard Ted point out earlier, is what is available mean, and that's always a debate locally, because whether or not land is vacant, whether someone wants to sell it or not, of course, is a different question. Whether land can be easily redeveloped is another part of that equation.
Yeah, My final question, Mr. Chair, is the commission and the staff working for the commission has an obligation in reviewing comprehensive plans to look at the public facilities plan. And does this speak to the fact that there isn't adequate planning for schools, that the process has failed?
Chair, Senator Beyer, I think the fact that about 5 years ago, there was a major amendment to the UGB process, and that was done primarily at the legislature, although there was considerable testimony from other parties in the process. The amendments that were made 5 years ago said that from now on, cities and counties are required to provide for school siting when they estimate land needed for their UGBs. We're just now getting to the point where UGBs throughout the state are going to start bumping up against that 20-year supply. I think there were plenty of very generous UGBs approved in the first round. We're going to see UGBs amended usually at the periodic review process, and because of the amendments that the legislature made a few years ago, we now, only now, are going to see cities calculating and trying to in some way plan for land for school siting. I think, I wouldn't say it failed, but we should have done that the first round, but we're now going to do that in the second round, and I think that should take a lot of the pressure off regarding the issues we've heard today. But that hasn't been around long enough for very many cities to respond to that statute, and therefore I think it's correct. There's probably a lot of lack of school sites.
I just have one more. Do most of the top plans in the zones, and I guess specifically in the metro area, allow for the siting of a school in any residential area?
Chair, Senator Beyer, yeah, most comp plans that I have reviewed do authorize a school in a residential zone.
They're not site. They wouldn't be site specific.
Typically, they don't say this is where the school site will go.
So they would have the option of being able to put it on any piece of ground that is zoned residential.
Where that's authorized, and as I say, it's probably not everywhere.
A local issue,
but most of them.
Senator Miller.
On the testimony provided here from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, from Richard Benner, Director, the final paragraph begins with the word we. Can you tell me who that defines?
Sure, Senator Miller, that's the department. The director submits all the testimony to you on behalf of the department.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Senator Courtney?
We spent all the time talking about the school here. Right? That puzzles me, because when I look at the heading on the bill, and his request comes in, I see Oregon Growing Industry Association and Oregon Growing Association Metropolitan Portland.
What's going on here? School district?
Well, this would be Ryan Becker.
I don't understand what that's all about.
School district isn't here.
What?
The fact that the school district isn't even here?
Yeah, I mean, at least Silverton, when they made a run at this thing, there's no doubt that Silverton was trying to build a school outside the Evansville Foundry, and we had that little discussion. There's no doubt that what Representative Byers tried a few years ago, what it was trying to do. I find it interesting, and I realize the bill's going to move, but I do think it's fascinating to spend all our conversation on Beaverton and Hillsboro and the need to build this school up against it and everything like that. But that's not who is at least representatives is saying they want the bill. And I find it interesting.
Thank you. I believe Cat Egan was representing the Beaverton School District.
And so was Representative Deckert and
If I could just address that real briefly, again, for the record, Pat Egan, Beaverton and Hillsborough School District, Chairman Starr, Senator Courtney. I wasn't aware of this legislation when it was initially introduced. We have a similar bill. Beaverton and Hillsborough School District has a similar bill. We initially also put in legislation that encompasses Section 2, which provides for the extension of urban services to a school site if they're sited in in an urban reserve, and that's when we were really brought in on the House side and House Water and Environment Committee on this particular bill. I think had we been asked, and I don't know, you know, in the printing process what happened here, but I don't think it's a subversion, and Chandler obviously would have to speak for the builders on this, but I think had we been asked, we probably would have signed on to it. So.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on the work section on House Bill 3259.
There was one other witness. Was there?
I
don't see one signed up, but she would like to testify. Briefly, you've got 1 minute.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Phil Fell from Wiggum, Oregon Cities. Thanks for the quick opportunity. I'll use it quickly. I would encourage you to disregard this bill and to make the current system work. Under current law, schools can condemn. There is also, as has been mentioned, the existing planning requirement. If we want schools to be able to have access to cheap property, then schools should get involved in the planning process. We will identify areas out in the urban reserve. Please keep in mind that the urban reserve, as already noted, is for a period 10 to 30 years in the future. This bill is not happening in a vacuum. There's a bill that's winding its way to the governor that establishes a Byzantine system for figuring certain kinds of land within the UGB. I'm sure that that bill will not result in less available land within the boundary. Another bill moving through the process is Senate Bill 1187, which will remove the requirement and the urbanization goal that restricts urban levels of development in those exception areas that are going to be within the urban reserve. So that bill will open it up to, if it passes in conjunction with this, would certainly open the areas to significant development, and as Senator Courtney has pointed out, on page 3, lines 13, 16, this is not just a school bill, this is a bill to allow single-family dwellings out in urban reserves. That puts a major burden on taxpayers, Mr. Chair. If they save the money from the school district, they're going to spend it in supplying the necessary services. They ought not be required to pay for services both within and outside the urban growth boundary. We're opposed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one very quick question.
Yes.
If I could, Mr. Chair. Do you represent, or do you know, do you represent the opinion of the cities of Hillsborough and Beaverton, or do you know what their position is on this bill?
They haven't contacted us about this bill, so I wouldn't know.
Thank you.
The desire of the chair to move the bill. I would accept the motion to do so. We close the public hearing and open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3259 to the floor be passed.
Mr. Chair, can I just make one statement before we take the victorious vote?
Yes.
You know, I served 6 years in the front city council. I also served 2 years in the Illinois Mass Transit District. And I guess I won't say I took offense, but this idea that it takes so long to make decisions, we live in a state that really believes in just core democracy. And when you serve in local government, as I have, either school board or city council transit district, that's the way we do things in Oregon. It takes a while to decide land use decisions. I mean, it really does. It takes a lot of public hearings, there's a lot of input, and that's a part of what we're about. The fact that we can't quickly do some of these things, that's our political system. And I think those people, that's why I'm so taken with people who cut their teeth in local government. I mean, it's hard, it's time-consuming, and it's painstaking. It truly is. So I just want that to be sure everybody understands, simply because you can't immediately amend an urban growth boundary or immediately develop the zone, there's reasons for that. And the reasons are, we promote participatory democracy, neighborhood association, public input. And I just think that that's something that what we're all about is the initiative process. So I just want to put that on the record.
Thank you very much.
Further comments? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Boyle?
No.
Senator
Bryan?
Aye.
Senator
Courtney?
I'm a no.
Senator Dorn?
No.
Chair
Sun? Aye. Mr. Chairman, as a favor to Representative Becker's change to an aye and allow this to proceed to the floor, I wouldn't count on it. Final vote.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. The I haven't received the necessary majority. House Bill 3259 is moved to the floor for the pass recommendation. Chair will carry.
With that, we're
going to adjourn or recess until 5 p.m. The committee on rules and elections, Chair.
Okay.